This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, May 11th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut, Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. And Taylor, we had another episode, two episodes of The Last Dance last night. Did you see me on there? I was on there. Did you notice me?
You were. I did not. I feel ashamed admitting that. Where were you?
I was on there. I told you. I think I was at the press conference when Jordan announced his first retirement.
Oh, right.
Before he went into baseball. And I knew exactly where I was sitting. And so I was kind of looking. I'm like, you know what? Is I there? And there I was, the back of my head with that his at that time still had all the hair intact.
Very cool. Nice little peek there. And our guy Tito Francona was on there and he was talking about things that he already talked about on the Baseball Tonight podcast, which
well,
I thought was
let's
cool.
Face. Because he had more time. His stories to us were a lot better than they were on The Last Dance. Yeah, I think you'd agree with that.
For sure. He got shortchanged.
And that was posted on Friday if you want to go and find those. Today we'll be talking with Chris Antonetti, the head of baseball operations for the Cleveland Indians. And he's got stories about how the blockbuster trade for Andrew Miller in 2016 came together and about Game 7 of the World Series, including a Major League Baseball suggestion that both he and Theo Epstein were very much against that night. But first, a few notes. It's official. Major League Baseball will cut its 2020 draft to five rounds as owners looking to save costs in the wake of the coronavirus push for fewer rounds over the objection of front office officials. This, according to sources who spoke with our Jeff Passan and Kylie McDaniel, the plan, which had been relayed to scouting directors, will allow teams to sign an unlimited number of undrafted players for a maximum of $20,000. The draft is expected to begin on June 10th. We'll be talking with Kylie McDaniel about all that on the podcast on Tuesday. Our friend Jesse Rogers wrote over the weekend that players believe that the risk of a return will be inherent due to the ongoing issues related to the pandemic, and compensation should account for that. The quote from Yankees catcher and executive board member Chris Iannetta, it goes back to not having fans in the stands. If there's no fans in the stands, there is an intrinsic risk that players are going to undertake. There is an intrinsic risk that support staff and coaches are going to undertake, and we should get fairly compensated for taking that risk for the betterment of the game. Yes, they could put a plan together, but the players and the owners have to agree on compensation, and they are entrenched. Japanese baseball hopes to start their season in June. We'll get more information about that in the days ahead. And I got to say, if they're struggling to protect people in the White House, I don't know how they protect 2,000 baseball players and staffers, Taylor. You saw the news in recent days about people in the White House are testing positive, where people get tested more than certainly just about any place else in this country.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that, I mean, throughout all the, I mean, I feel like we're at such a weird place in this country where it's like, are we going back to normal? Are we not? And the place where they, you know, need to make these decisions, they can't keep those folks safe. So what are they going to do with these players? I've heard some chatter from, I do a golf podcast as well. And, you know, the word on the street with the golfers is, you know, they're ready to take the risks. So I wonder if baseball players just kind of feel the same. They're just like, we just got to do it. We just got to get back to work and give it a shot. I don't know how much weight that kind of general opinion will hold when they're making this decision, but it's pretty interesting to see how it's all going to play out for sure.
Yeah, I'd say this, a lot fewer golfers than baseball players. Like, you know, it would be hard to get an absolute consensus to that and something that I think every player would participate in, but we'll have to wait and see. We're going to get more information on that as the week goes ahead. Before we get to Chris Iannetta and to Sarah Langs, be sure to listen to Jalen and Jacoby, the after show, the recapping episodes 7 and 8 of The Last Dance with director Jason Hare. We finally got some baseball talk in episode 7, which we just referenced. It was an appearance by our friend Terry Francona talking about managing Jordan in Birmingham. Check out the after show presented by State Farm and AT&T wherever you get your podcasts. If you've yet to do so, check out our interviews with Tito from Friday. Let's get to Sarah.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs, a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, coming up, we'll be talking with Chris Antonetti, the head of baseball operations for the Cleveland Indians. And I'm going to ask him about Game 7 of the 2016 World Series, which the Indians lost, but obviously a really big game in baseball history. I don't know if I have it as the best game ever. Which one do you consider to be the best game ever?
That's a really good question. I mean, I will certainly say that it's the best one that I have had the honor to be at. So it certainly sticks out in my mind for that reason. But I don't know. I mean, I guess that for game sevens, I always default to that Bumgarner performance because it was just so incredible. But in terms of the actual, although that game was closer than anyone ever realizes, because all you talk about is Bumgarner, you don't realize how close the game was. But, you know, both of these had some back and forth tight game type of situations, which I think is just, you know, exactly what you want in game seven. I always thought it was interesting because, like, 2016, the series itself wasn't nearly as tight, but then game seven was so incredible. And then in 2017, game seven was pretty much a laugher. It was done in like the second inning, but the series itself was so tight. We had the walk off and all of that other stuff in that Dodgers Astros series. So I thought it was funny, like that sort of juxtaposition of those two, where the game seven wasn't as good in 2017, but the overall series probably was better.
Along those lines, what do you have on game seven in 2016, which of course had the Rajay Davis home run in the eighth inning, and then you had the rain delay, and then you had the Cubs winning in extra innings?
Yeah. So, I mean, just in terms of memories, I've got some great ones of the home run and of that rain delay. We were there doing a baseball night in SportsCenter, and I was with ESPN, and we were in a trailer that was basically a parking lot behind where the stadium was. And we get a feed in there where we're a little bit ahead of what everyone's watching at home, you know, only a couple seconds. So you sort of know what's happening a little bit in advance. But because of the position of our trailer, which was right outside the stadium, we knew even further in advance what was going on because we would hear the cheers. And we were getting ready to go to the field. We're going to do post game. The Cubs are going to win the World Series. This is all so great. So much history. And then we hear this crazy cheer. Rajay Davis is at the plate. And I'm like, oh my goodness. I think this game is tied. I think something just happened. And lo and behold, we see it on the TV, you know, a second later. That was just like one of those chills kind of moments when something like that happened. And sitting in a room, not seeing it happen that second and then seeing it a second later on the TV. And we spent the rain delay in the old visitors bullpen at Progressive Field because they changed the bullpens. They moved them to kind of in center field. You can see them when you're looking like from the batter's eye out into center field. But they used to be on the field level and they turned into the seating area. And that's where we were taken because we had to be ready to go on the field and do our post game show immediately when the game ended. And we went there even before the rain delay started. And we were just standing there with some fans who were just, you know, standing there with their ESPN broadcasters chatting. I remember them chatting up Carl and Jess and whoever else. And that was a pretty crazy place to witness all of that happening. But I also took a look at the win probability from those final few innings there. So entering the bottom of the eighth inning, when the Cubs were up 6-3, the Cubs had a 93% chance to win the game. And it went up to 95% when Lester got Lindor to ground out and Napoli to strike out. And then Jose Ramirez hits a single. It's 94%. That's when Chapman comes into the game. Then Brandon Guyer hits his RBI double. It drops to 86% for the Cubs. And then Davis hits the two-run homer, ties the game, and it's 47% chance for the Cubs. So the Indians finally have the higher percentage chance to win. And at the end of the inning, it was 50-50. The lowest that the Cubs win probability got to in that game was 35%. Because in the top of the ninth, remember, there was a little bit of action for the Cubs, and Dexter Fowler grounded out to end the inning with Jason Hayward at third. That was the lowest that it was for the Cubs. It dropped to 35%. But then obviously it went back up. The Indians didn't do anything. The Cubs scored in the next inning after the rain delay and everything else.
Oh, my God. Now, the Cubs won the World Series. And so, you know, 20, 30 years from now, Aroldis Chapman could be invited back and throw out a first pitch in Wrigley Field. Can you imagine the reaction to him if they had lost that game?
I know. I mean, it was incredible. That's what I was thinking as this was happening. Like, this is the guy. This is the trade they made. That was the we are going to win the World Series trade. We've talked about it so many times. It wasn't a trade for the regular season. It was a trade for Game 7 of the World Series. And here he was doing that. I mean, and you think of, you know, there's such a history of outstanding relievers, honestly, doing something a little bit wrong right there and it costing a team a World Series. I mean, you can think of Mariano Rivera, right? He's absolutely Hall of Famer, no question. Everyone voted for him, all of this stuff. And, you know, you think of 2001. So I was thinking, is this his moment like that? So, you know, good for him for the vindication, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Sarah, great to talk with you. Later in the week, we'll be talking with Gary Cohn. I know he's one of your favorites from SNY, Mets broadcaster, as we go along with Broadcasters Week. Thanks for doing it.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Chris Antonetti is the president of baseball operations for the Cleveland Indians. And Chris, thanks for taking the time to join us for some storytelling and helping to distract us.
My pleasure, Buster. Always great to be with you.
So I've been talking with some of your peers, and one of my favorite questions to ask of them is, give me a big deal that you talked about, but it didn't come together. And Sandy Alderson told me about offering a roster spot to get Michael Jordan on the Oakland Athletics. And when we talked to Ned Colletti, he talked about feeling like he nearly pulled off a trade for CC Sabathia in the summer of 2008. And it was very interesting because I asked him after he ran through it, and he ran through the fact that owner Frank McCourt didn't approve the trade. And I said, I know you were having really positive conversations with Chris Antonetti, but do you feel like if he had said yes, that you would have gotten the deal done? He goes, you know, Chris seemed disappointed when we pulled out of the talks because we didn't get approval on it. But when you talk to Chris, ask him if we would have gotten CC if we'd gotten approval for that. So here's my question. In the end, you wound up trading him to the Brewers. How close were the Dodgers?
The Dodgers were close. They were one of the final few teams in it. In fact, we were going back and forth late into the night. And as I remember, like Ned had, he had like some dentist appointment at one point where he, you know, couldn't access his cell phone and was like panicked that he would miss out on the deal. And then his cell phone died. So Kim Ng, who was the assistant GM at the time, had to reach out to call us to try to figure out where things were. So it was close. The Dodgers were definitely in the thick of things. And CC could have very easily become a Los Angeles Dodger.
So if they had the deal that blew up because it didn't get approved, if that had been on the table, do you think that he winds up with the Dodgers?
That would have been the consideration for us. I think at that point we were trying to line up the kind of the best offers from teams. And at that point, the Brewers and Dodgers had emerged as the top two teams. And what we were seeking to do was get a great offer from the Dodgers that they could actually move forward on. And then we would have weighed that against the deal with Milwaukee, but it would have been a really tough decision for us.
All right. Now, in that case, you guys were sellers. In the summer of 2016, you were buyers, and the trade you made that year for reliever Andrew Miller helped to take you guys all the way to Game 7 of the World Series that year. What was so unusual was that the Yankees, for the first time that we could ever remember, were actually sellers. Walk us through sort of how that came together for you guys.
Yeah, for a while I felt I was stalking Brian Cashman because I was calling him almost every day trying to get a check-in because he had a number of players that were, you know, he was talking about at that point in time. And Cash is always awesome to deal with because he's so transparent and so upfront. And he was really clear from the outset. He's like, listen, my responsibility is to work through and understand what the market is for our players. You know, there are a lot of things that we need to work through internally before we get to the point of being able to move forward. So I'm happy to stay engaged, happy to connect with you, but just know this could change at any minute. And we could decide not to move any of these guys. And that was the case all the way through the time, literally the day that we traded for him. His ability to be able to move forward on that was, you know, uncertain just because it was such an unusual position for the Yankees to be in. And obviously required considerable ownership conversations on his end.
How quickly did you guys wind up agreeing to the prospects that want to be in that deal? Sheffield and, of course, Clint Frazier.
It took quite a while. Yeah, the negotiations took, I'd say more than a month. That whole process took, I think we narrowed down some of the primary pieces. Cash was really clear. Frazier needed to be in it. We talked about, I think, 50 different versions of things. And I remember as we were the closest we were get, I felt we started to have a chance for him. Actually, I was on a trip with my family at a resort and I was on a rock climbing wall. I took a phone call from Cash just to make sure I didn't miss it, at that point in time to talk through, some of the secondary players we might be able to line up on. And following that call, I felt we were, optimistic or got some sense of optimism we might be able to close things out.
So you literally were on the rock climbing wall. I'm guessing your kids might, hey, Dad, come on, let's go.
Yeah. I was literally next to my daughter on a rock climbing wall. It was a two-person rock climbing wall, and we were kind of trying to race up to the top. And at that point, we were neck and neck, and I stopped, and obviously there's a belay, so you're on a rope, you're not going to fall off. And she kept going. She was happy that she won, and I was happy because we were closer to getting Andrew Miller.
Now, down the stretch for that deal to be made, a couple more things. Did you have irons in the fire on other relievers, plan Bs, if you don't get Andrew Miller? And if you remember, the Yankees actually won a series of games close to that deadline, as that being thrown into the mix as to whether or not they're going to trade Andrew. Do you remember any of that?
Oh, I remember that vividly, actually. We were, and again, Cash, to his credit, was really upfront. He said, hey, the way we play this weekend, I think they were playing Tampa at the time.
Yep.
He said that could be really influential for the direction we decide to go. So he literally said, I'm not sure where we'll end up on this. You know, at that point, he was talking to Hal Steinbrenner and said, we'll have to see where this goes. But from a baseball standpoint, I think we're moving towards something we'd recommend. But getting ownership approval is something that I really need to work through deliberately, and how we play this weekend could impact their thoughts on it.
How pivotal do you think that getting Andrew was for how far you guys made it that postseason?
No question. We would not have made it nearly as far without Andrew. I think our team, as it was going into the playoffs in 2016, we had lost a number of guys to injuries at that point. And Andrew just shouldered such an extraordinary load for us throughout the postseason. And we relied on him so heavily, and he pitched so well, obviously, as evidenced by his championship series MVP as a reliever, and the not only the amount of innings but the quality of innings that he pitched and how pivotal those were in the games we played. So without Andrew, we wouldn't have been playing in the World Series.
Now, how much Terry, certainly there was a lot of focus on Tito for the way that he handled your guys' bullpen, especially in the first two rounds of that postseason. How much of the structure that you guys came up with was talked about going into games? In other words, was there talk of, hey, if we have this certain situation, certain matchup in the fifth inning, maybe this is something we go to?
So we talked about that quite extensively prior to acquiring Andrew, just the versatility that he provided, the fact that he not only dominated left-handed hitters, but right-handed hitters as well. So really could be used in any leverage spot anywhere in the game and for multiple innings. And that was one of the reasons why we were willing to part with such a premium prospect package, was because of that versatility. And also, he's such a selfless teammate that he was willing to pitch whenever the game mattered and didn't need to just wait for the eighth or ninth inning. So we talked about that extensively when we acquired him. And then going into the postseason, that was clearly going to be one of our strategies. But we didn't do it on a game-to-game level. Obviously, I've got great faith and trust in Tito to determine the best times to put players in to position them and the team for success. And I'm not sure there's anyone better in the game at doing that than Tito. So the game-to-game decisions we left with him, but on the vision for the role and how Andrew could impact our team, we spent quite a bit of time talking about that.
In talking with a lot of your peers through the years, they talk about October as being a time when they feel absolutely helpless. I mean, you are at the top of baseball operations for the Indians, but in that 1 month, so much is out of your hands. What's that like to watch that on a day-to-day basis, and how much are you sleeping?
There's so many emotions, obviously, at that time of year. And, in our seat at that point, a lot of the work is done. Once you get through the advanced scouting meetings, and preparation, there's not a whole lot you can do. So you're watching the game like anyone else. And the emotions, you had the roller coaster of emotions. I think one of the things we tried to do deliberately as a staff and as an organization during that postseason time was make sure we enjoyed the ride. I think we all were cognizant of the fact just how special that team was, how special some of the accomplishments they achieved together were, and we wanted to make sure we just didn't skip to the end and not enjoy the journey. So we tried to be really deliberate about it. We involved our entirety of our baseball operations and organization and inviting them to the postseason and World Series, and trying to create a lot of moments and memories. And I think if you talk to a lot of people within our organization, despite the final outcome and not winning that last game, they'll look back on that as an extraordinary time and with some great memories that they cherish.
So when the last out is made in the American League Championship Series and you guys are propelled to the World Series, what do you remember about that moment and what you did right after that?
Yeah, we were in a suite in Toronto watching it with a few members of our baseball operations, and Paul Dolan and his wife Karen were there. And first thing I did, I remember turning, gave Mike Chernoff a huge hug, and then there were lots of hugs and high fives there was one suite in the ballpark that was celebrating, and the rest of the Rogers Center was pretty quiet. So those are some special moments. And then the thing I'll remember after that is in the clubhouse, there was some great moments of celebration, but the class and the dignity of Mark Shapiro to stop down and congratulate us, and the moment we shared together was something I'll always remember, because Mark's not only been an incredible mentor for me and friend, but also was a huge part of building that team. And I know he's disappointed that his team didn't win, but you know, came over and we shared a moment. I'll always remember, you know, Mark's words during that time.
Now, Game 7 of the World Series, one of the most memorable games in history, in part because of your guys' comeback. Can you describe what you remember when Rajay Davis hits the game-tying home run?
Yeah, that game was so hard because, you know, we thought we were well-positioned and lined up with, you know, Klibbs on the mound again, and our bullpen, we felt we were in a decent spot. And, you know, guys that we had relied on up to that point, just they weren't at their best that day, which is certainly understandable given the workload that they had absorbed to get us to that point. So, you know, there were some moments of it was pretty quiet leading up to that. And then, you know, as we started to mount the comeback, you could feel the energy pick up a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more. Then you saw Chapman maybe wasn't as sharp as he possibly could have been. And then when Raj connected on that home run down, it was the loudest I've ever heard a ballpark. I'm sure I'm biased of that because of my affiliation with the team, but it was bonkers in the ballpark that night. It was bonkers in the suite where we were watching the game, and it was really a moment of euphoria. There are very few moments you have like that, but that was one of those. And then immediately after that, you got back to the reality of like, wait, the game's tied. We've got a lot of work still left to do. Most surreal experience of my baseball career so far. When Theo, Jed, Mike Chernoff, and I we descended into like this dugout suite behind the plate. And like we had just been, obviously, it's game 7 of the World Series. The emotions, we're all emotionally spent. The game's been a roller coaster. Raj just hit the home run. And now we're sitting in the suite behind home plate. And Theo and I were just looking at each other like, really? A rain delay right now? And then Rob actually at one point, because they were uncertain of the weather forecast, Fox was wanting us to just, you know, if it looked doubtful, just stop the game there and pick it up the following day at 8:00.
You're kidding. That would have been like a drag race, you know?
Exactly. Imagine that. So Theo and I were just like, we need to finish the game tonight. So
again, you're competitive. Theo's competitive in that moment, but you guys are collegial, and that sort of overstrips everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was like, yeah, there was like no game. It was just literally just because of the way the series went and the emotions and how, you know, we're all exhausted at the end of a long season, and the way that game played out with the roller coaster of emotions, we were all just gassed to have the rain delay on top of it. It was kind of hard to believe. And then when there was some conversation about stopping that game and then trying to pick it up the next day at 8:00 or whatever that time was, I'm not sure either one of us would have made it to the next day at that point.
I asked Dave Dombrowski after the Tigers played the Red Sox in 2013 American League Championship Series, and I asked him the following spring, how long did it take you to sort of get past that loss? And he said, I get past these losses very easily. But if you remember that series between the Red Sox and the Tigers dominated about 80% of it. Like, it seemed like every game their starting pitcher was carrying a no-hitter into the middle innings, and yet they lose that series. And he said it took them a long time. For you as a competitor, because you're not getting into this without being competitive, how long before you're able to turn the page from that World Series?
I'll let you know when it happens, Buster. I mean, you look back and you think about, you replay the game and just different things that could have gone, the other way. And, you sometimes think back on those. I still haven't rewatched game 7 in its entirety, but I've got enough memories to know how close we were. So, it's something I still process and think back on from time to time.
Will you think you'll ever watch it all the way through?
I think I will. I mean, I'm sure I will at some point. I mean, I love baseball. I love the game. Obviously, the drama of that. It was a special time for, you know, those of us within the baseball operations group there and my family. And we had a lot of bonding and memorable moments along the way. So I'm sure I'll look to relive them at some point. I just haven't had the uh, haven't had the courage to rewatch it yet.
Tell me about the first time that you laid eyes on CC Sabathia.
So I was a young assistant in baseball operations, and CC had been drafted a couple of years before. And I mean, I'm sure you've probably heard the stories of CC when he signed with the organization of, you know, not using the seams on the baseball, just kind of getting it and throwing. But by the time I had seen him, you know, he had started to really mature because he's such an extraordinary athlete. And I know it may not look it when you first see CC, but he is an extraordinary athlete, obviously an incredibly intelligent guy. So his learning curve was about as fast as any player or any pitcher that I can remember. And I remember sitting behind the plate he was a 20-year-old, made the team out of spring training. Charlie Manuel pounded the table for him. And he was this left-hander, huge, physical, athletic guy with up to 100 miles an hour, great, great feel for a changeup, and at the time a developing breaking ball. But when he clicked it, it was something special. So it was, you knew you were watching something and the start of something of what had to be, what could be an incredible career. And to CC's credit, he reinvented himself a few times throughout or along the way, but it was fun to see. And I'm looking forward to the day he's inducted into the Hall of Fame, because he's certainly deserves that honor.
I'll always believe he's the best teammate that I ever witnessed, but I wasn't on the inside the way you were. What are some examples of CC as a teammate that you saw?
Oh, there are so many. And I think, I mean, if you talk to those other people that have acquired CC or have been around him, whether they're managers, coaches, clubhouse staff, they'll all tell you the same thing. They're main mate. And I think he was the first person to, you know, when something went wrong, he'd stand up and say, "Hey, I need to be better, but I also need you to be better." And because he held himself to such a high standard in how he worked, how he prepared, how he competed, that, and how much he cared, not only about, you know, his own performance, but the team's performance, that gave him the platform to lead. And he did that in such an extraordinary way and found a way to connect with every player and was a unifying guy, a unifying presence in every clubhouse he was ever in, from the time he was, 18 years old with us in the minor leagues all the way through his, final years with the Yankees.
Yeah, that was part of the pitch that Brian Cashman made to him, was, "We need you to change our clubhouse. We need you to pull all these groups together." How did he do that, Chris, when he was in your clubhouse?
So he genuinely, CC cares genuinely about people. And I think people knew that CC cared about him. And like I said, he would set the standard by the way he acted. He's not one of those guys, there are people all the time that talk about, they talk the talk, but don't follow through. And CC was one of those guys that did. And I think he earned respect with the way he acted. And within a clubhouse, he found ways to connect with each person on an individual level. And that allowed him, again, the ability to, when there needed to be a tough conversation, he already had the relationship in place to have those.
Tell me about the first time you laid eyes on Francisco Lindor.
Yeah, that was an instructional league. At the time, obviously I had seen all the video and had seen all of the information we had when we drafted him, but did not see him live until instructional league. And when you saw him, the first thing that stands out is just the enthusiasm for which he played the game. I mean, he has, he loves being out there. He loves competing. He loves, and the thing that stood out probably more than anything is how much he loved to practice, and how much he just liked being on a baseball field. And then you could just see the athleticism, his actions at shortstop, the way he played the game, stood out. At the time, it wasn't evident, and I'd be lying if I said it stood out on the way in which he impacted the ball. That wasn't a strength of his. At the time he was 17, he had some really good ingredients to hit, but I wouldn't have sat there at that point and said, "Hey, this is a guy that's going to hit 30 home runs in the big leagues at some point in time." But his presence on the field and his enthusiasm immediately stood out.
And I want to ask you lastly about Terry Francona. I remember when I worked on Sunday Night Baseball with him for that 1 year, I didn't really press him because I was a teammate about what he wanted to do. But I assumed, because he'd had so much success with the Red Sox, that he would wind up with a big market team. And then when he signed with you guys, he said to me, he said, "This is going back, and this is like family for me." What are some experience you've had with Terry Francona as your manager?
So grateful and thankful that Tito had that perspective and was willing to partner with us at, back in 2012, because at the time we were coming off a very rough stretch as an organization and hadn't been to the playoffs in a few years. And we knew we needed to get better at the major league level. We knew we needed to improve our minor league system. And we also were cognizant of our market realities. And Tito from day one said, I want to be part of the solution. I'm energized by those challenges. I'm not intimidated by them. And I want to be part of helping, you know, the organization rebuild. And from the day he arrived, he's lived up to that and more. And I've shared this before, but as excited as I was on the day we hired him, I'm even more excited 8 years later to have the opportunity to continue to work alongside him, because he's a Hall of Fame manager and he gets a lot of recognition for the tactical things that he does on the field and how successful his team is. But he's also an extraordinary leader for an organization that helps bring people together and help unite people. And he's been he's had such an extraordinary impact on our franchise over the last 8 years.
Because he's so easygoing and everybody likes him, and you know, he's so welcoming to people, whether it's players or whether it's member of the media. I think the part that gets lost about him is how competitive he is. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, Tito has the self-effacing humor, but he's brilliant. He's extraordinarily competitive, and he's a great athlete. He's the type of guy that you watch him pick up a golf club and swing a golf club, or just pick up a basketball and shoot it, and you're like, wow, that's a good athlete. And he hates to lose. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is, if it's cribbage before the game, if it's baseball, if it's shooting free throws, he hates losing. But he does it in such a great way, and the way he competes, he makes it fun. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so enjoyable to work alongside Tito, is not only does he have all of these great attributes, but he's a lot of fun to be around, and I consider him a close and dear friend.
Have you ever played a game with him of some kind, whether it is golf or whether you are shooting free throws?
Oh yeah, we'll play Scrabble on his, you know, on his phone, and yeah, he'll compete in Scrabble on his phone. So he'll want to wager on it. Yeah, usually he'll want to wager on it, and I'm smart enough not to do that. But he is very competitive on everything.
All right, Chris. Well, I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure, Buster. Always great to catch up.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Monday. Our friend Savage and the Beast at Savage and Beast writes in, 1 year for Mother's Day, I took my mom to Yankee Stadium and we sat about 30 feet from Bernie Williams, her favorite player, in right field. It was a great day. Do you have any favorite baseball memories with your moms? And I was actually thinking about this yesterday, unprompted, from Savage and Beast. And shout out to Kathy Schwenk, because I was in second grade and it was my birthday, and being the gullible 7 or 8 year old I was, she said, I got to pull you out of school early. You got a doctor's appointment. We're getting ready to go. She said, you want to put on your Orioles hat before we go? And I was like, yeah, sure. Whatever, mom. Threw it on, picked it up off the bed, and underneath were 2 tickets to game 2 of the ALCS against the Cleveland Indians. So that was quite the memorable birthday. They lost that game, but great time. And I'll always remember that one with my mom.
Yeah, so you and I were in the same ballpark at the same time.
I was wondering if you were there that day or not.
Heck yeah, I absolutely was there. For me, I've said in the past that I'm the only member of my family among my siblings, my parents, who like sports. The rest of them can't stand sports. I'm the black sheep. When I go back, I talk about cows. I talk about pumpkins. I talk about managing fields with my brother. But I never talk about sports. But yet my mom was the one who really got me interested in baseball. She got me a book on Sandy Koufax when I was 8. She got me my first packs of baseball cards. The first baseball card I ever saw was Gary Sutherland, who played with the Houston Astros. And I told the story about how on the morning after Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's record, she left a note for me on the kitchen table. So when I came down to go out to the barn in the morning, she wrote out the details from the night before that Hank Aaron broke the record, and as she wrote, the crowd cheered. So my mom was absolutely instrumental for my interest in baseball, which she probably regretted in later years when she found herself tripping over my stacks of baseball cards.
Right. Well, it led you to your career and the man you are today, so it was maybe not all regret there from your mother. Shout out to Mrs. Only. We got one from Aaron, Aaron San Diego. He writes in, over the years, I have heard and tried some wild ways to break in a glove. Some of my favorites include putting it under your mattress or baking it in the oven. What is the weirdest way you've heard an MLB player break in a glove?
You know what? In the next couple of weeks, I think we're going to have on a person who'd be absolutely perfect to answer that question. So, Taylor, let's hold Aaron's question for, let's say, about 2 weeks from now. I think we're going to get this person on. He will give a perfect answer. By the way, I was just going to mention, just for my friends who listen to the podcast, my mom's name was Mary Lincoln.
Wow, sorry. She got married.
No, that's okay. But just in case people who know me were like, who's this Mrs. Only person?
Whoops. All right. Last one for today. Heath writes in, with Major League Baseball losing revenue due to COVID-19, do you think this will speed up the relocation expansion process? If so, do you think Portland will get a team through one of those options? He notes the Portland Diamond Project as one such movement vying for a baseball team.
Initially, I think it's going to slow it down. Like, we've talked about how can you imagine if you're the Tampa Bay Rays or the Oakland Athletics and you're looking for help, support in building a new ballpark? Good luck with that right now, with where the economy is in this country, generally speaking. But I do wonder if in a couple of years, once the situation with the economy gets stabilized, if it may accelerate, because you're going to see major league owners, having lost a lot of money during this time, are looking for ways to fill in. One of those ways is to sell a couple of expansion franchises. So I think, you know, within 4 or 5 years, you're going to hear more talk about that.
Interesting. That'll do it for Bleacher Tweets. Subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And tune in tomorrow. We got Dan Schulman telling some phenomenal stories. I can't wait for everyone to hear Buster's interview with him.
Yeah, this is the beginning of what we're going to call Broadcaster Week. It might actually spill over longer than that, but we have some great guests lined up. As we talked to with Sarah Gary Cohen of the SNY Network, who does the Mets games, Dan Schulman, and we're going to be talking with Mike Greenberg about of Get Up fame,
nice.
About his baseball memory. So it'll be very cool. Plus, we're going to have him rate and review Hembo, which is going to be a lot of fun. That's it for today. My thanks to Chris Antonetti, to Sarah Langs, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.